Thank you all for joining us for today's Fluent Internet Seminar, and I will ask Scott Miller from EPA Region 4 to unmute themselves, and I'll call up your materials, and feel free to take it away.
Thank you, Jane. Today we'll discuss EPA's involvement in collaborating with colleges and universities to assist communities in pursuing redevelopment opportunities and plans at sites. Here's a preview of what we'll be covering today. I will start with some brief background on Superfund redevelopment and the benefits of redeveloping contaminated properties. Bill Denman from the EPA Region 4 Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch will then present on the Superfund Task Force and Goal 4 Recommendation 39. We have our college partners here. Dr. Robert Benedict from the Clemson University School of Real Estate, Dr. Kwame Owusu-Deku from the University of West Florida, and Dr. Andrew Gano from Maryville College. First, I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for working with us. I won't take anything away from the presentations that they're about to make. All I'll say is that good things come to those who work hard, and these folks worked hard and in concert with us, and we created some really positive outcomes together, and we just so appreciate what it is that they have done with us to date. And I will conclude the webinar with some Superfund redevelopment tools, and there will be some time for questions and answers as well. Superfund redevelopment works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process at contaminated sites. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Contaminated sites pose unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, they can also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. Returning contaminated sites to productive use is an important part of EPA's mission. The Superfund Task Force developed recommendations for action and continues to diligently work to see the goals realized. If you're interested in finding out more about the task force, feel free to check out the link in the resources pod on the right of your screen. For more information about EPA Superfund redevelopment efforts, I would encourage you to visit the Superfund redevelopment website. The link to the website is here on the slide and also listed on the resources pod on the right side of your screen. I encourage you to visit the Redevelopment Partnerships page of the Superfund Redevelopment website to learn more about the specific organizations that have partnered with Superfund Redevelopment to assist in Superfund site reuse. Collaborating with these organizations helps Superfund Redevelopment provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. Superfund Redevelopment currently has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Observancy, the Trust for Public Lands, and Pollinator Partnership. These organizations are familiar with Superfund and willing to work with communities, municipalities, or other stakeholders to explore reuse opportunities and support for their local Superfund sites. One final note, please feel free to submit questions throughout the webinar. We will have time at the end for any questions. Now, Bill will take us through an overview of the Superfund Task Force goal for recommendation 39. Take it away, Bill.
Thank you, Scott. My name is Bill Denman, and I am chief of the Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch, but I'm currently on a temporary assignment to headquarters working in the Superfund Redevelopment Program, where I've worked on and off for many years. And so today I'm here to talk about the Superfund Task Force and specifically recommendation number 39, which was part of Goal 4. So the Superfund Task Force, for those of you who don't know, began in May of 2017 when the administration called to develop the task force. And fortunately, I was selected to be a part of it, working primarily on the redevelopment component. And it was tasked with identifying ways to speed up the Superfund cleanup process, promote redevelopment of sites, and revitalize communities. And so a lot of the or the recommendations were kind of focused in on how that could be improved over time. And so between May and July 2017, we put together 42 recommendations for doing this, building on some past work, of course, that we've been thinking about, and interweaving some of the new and innovative ideas that of ways to help redevelop and get sites back into productive use. So the task force existed pretty much from July 2017 to 2019, and the recommendations were tracked, and the different progress was really prioritized, and a lot of good things came from it. So specifically, I'm going to hone in on goal four. There were five goals. Goal four was promoting redevelopment and community revitalization. And there were several recommendations under this goal specifically aimed at increasing the number of Superfund sites that have returned to productive use. And if you look at the 2019 Superfund accomplishments report, there's a great statement in there that says the ultimate goal of the Superfund program is how well we are able to clean up sites and return them to the communities for productive use so they can now be a benefit to those communities instead of maybe the eyesore or the problem that they may have been for years or even decades. So strategy one was to facilitate site redevelopment and support information sharing. And strategy two was to use reuse planning to lay the foundation and set expectations for site redevelopment. And that's obviously something any of you who have been involved in Superfund site redevelopment know, that it's important to plan for that reuse, to have champions in both on the state and local government and community levels, and have a clear vision of where you're trying to go. And so under recommendation number 39, to be more specific, it said to engage and facilitate public-private partnerships to share information and resources and work toward advancing and promoting revitalization. So in the past 2 years, EPA has done this. One of the ways that we're going to talk about today is the CUP program, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in just a minute. But we also provide regional seeds through the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which one of the things I'm working on is actually changing the perception of Superfund redevelopment from the initiative, being that we've been around for now 21 years, to a specific program. And so this is something that EPA has been committed to for quite some time. And through the Superfund Redevelopment Program, we provide regional seeds to the regions that can help provide funding to get some of this visioning and reuse planning done quickly and not have to wait until funding becomes available for it. And so headquarters can partially fund and get things started, and then the region can pick up and fully fund it as it's ongoing. And that's been very successful. As far as the future, EPA has fully integrated this recommendation into our mission of helping communities get sites put back into productive use. And certainly during the past year, 2 years, we've seen the success of that, and we're going to continue to work with communities to provide them the information, the reuse assessments, reuse planning, support, visioning, workshops. We're working on some GIS tools to better relay this information, regional seed. There's just a lot of things and as Scott mentioned, the Superfund Redevelopment webpage has a lot of information about these. And so if you're interested, please go to that website and take a look at it. So specifically today, we're going to talk about the College Underserved Community Partnership Program. And I know Scott has a lot of experience in this and has worked in the CUP program for a long time. And basically, the CUP program is where EPA helps connect colleges and universities to the communities that we're working in to help them provide some of the technical support through student internships and capstone projects. And so this is just a win-win-win for everyone, because the students get real-world projects to work on. They're actually able to go out and interview community members and, see what things are like, not just writing a paper or, coming up with some hypothetical. These are real projects that they're working on. And it can be a range of plans and projects that can help communities gain access to resources to improve their economic future and overall quality of life. I mean, they can help them with grant applications, which is something we can't do. They can help them with just all kinds of things. I know in one community we interviewed some of the elders the local university interviewed the local elders and helped preserve the stories that came out of this community, because this is a community that's getting a lot of development pressure from around it, and they're worried about losing their identity. And so one of the things that the university was able to help them with is to actually write down and preserve what that identity is or what is for the town, so it can be used going forward as to kind of guide them. And so there's a lot of things they can work on. They can work on, you know, it can be landscape architecture students that can help with, you know, some of the revitalization planning. Like I said, they can help them with grants. Just a lot of different ways that colleges and universities have the not only resources but enthusiasm of the students to work on projects. And these don't have to be just projects that can end in the semester. Some of them are ongoing, and students work on them and finish out their semester. Then other students come in and pick up where they left off. So it's just been a fantastic program. It's grown from 2013, when we started off working with four universities, to most recently we have 71 schools that we're partnering with that work in 64 different communities. So it's just a fantastic program, and I know we all look forward to hearing more about it. So with that, I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Robert Benedict from Clemson to talk about a specific project he's been involved with.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate the invitation to share this project with you, and likewise to Scott Miller. My name is Robert Benedict, and I'm a professor of practice and former director of the Master of Real Estate Development Program at Clemson University. I'd also like to acknowledge Dr. Bridget Trojan, who's in the audience. Bridget is an associate dean, and she is Clemson's liaison with the EPA's CUP program. So in the summer of 2019, Scott Miller approached us about the possibility of doing our practicum or capstone course on the historic Union Bleachery Cone Mills site in Greenville, South Carolina. This is in the upstate of South Carolina. The practicum is a graduate-level capstone course where our students are divided into teams, and they work all semester long to complete a comprehensive redevelopment proposal that is then presented to the stakeholders, developers in the community, local officials, and in this case, of course, the EPA. The jury critiques the various proposals. They're presented as if they are seeking a development partner, and then there is a winning team and a runner-up. A lot of drama. Some of the attributes of the location, it is near Furman University, which is a very prestigious liberal arts college, but is also within 15 minutes of downtown Greenville. It is, and this is significant, is located on the Reedy River, which flows through downtown Greenville, and adjacent to the Reedy River is a very popular biking and hiking trail known as the Swamp Rabbit Trail. The site has currently been under bank receivership, vacant, and of course a Superfund site. Now Scott Miller recently informed us with some very good news that this site is now under contract to be sold. So congratulations, Scott, on that. Let me give you a little bit of the history of the Union Bleachery and Cone Mills. And what Bill mentioned earlier is very true about how this was such a huge part of the community. The mill actually dates back to the early 20th century and was one of many on the outskirts of downtown Greenville, a city that boasted it was the textile capital of the country at one time. In fact, this area was known as the Textile Crescent. The mill was sold, I believe, in the 1980s to Cone Mills, who converted it from a textile mill, and it was a textile mill who had even manufactured lightweight Army uniforms during World War II. It was converted to a chromium finishing plant. And during the first decade of the 2000s, the mill suffered two devastating fires. Leaking chromium into the groundwater, and it became a heavily contaminated site. Cone Mills, the owner at that time, declared bankruptcy and basically walked away from the site. At that time, the state of South Carolina intervened, referred the site to the EPA, and under the EPA's Emergency Response and Removal Branch, They administer a time-critical remediation action. Going back to my earlier comment about the mill and the community, Union Bleachery anchored the San Suu Kyi community. The San Suu Kyi community was a community of haves and have-nots. It was very interesting. The country club for Greenville was located nearby, but at the same time, the mill was on the other side of the tracks. But it was a very vibrant community. And the mill owners built schools, churches, homes, and amenities, such as their own golf course, shuffleboard courses, annual barbecues. It was a very dynamic community, and the local streetcar system was actually extended to the mill, as they did with all of the mills in the Textile Crescent. Today, frankly, it resembles a war zone, and the main mill building, because of the fires, is gone. However, there are some remarkable extant historic structures, including the boiler building, the water filtration building, and several large warehouses that survived, and the site has enormous potential for redevelopment, and properties like this across the country have become prized adaptive use projects. So going back to the course itself, the practicum is a team-based capstone course. And I'll never forget, Scott Miller called me and he said, I understand you like to take on student projects that are challenged with environmental issues. Well, I didn't know really what I was getting into, but it was an amazing site to work on. As part of the practicum project, the students have to complete a very thorough site analysis, which in addition to the environmental conditions, this also includes zoning, topography, hydrology, access, and it goes on and on and on. They also must complete a very rigorous market analysis to determine what the market really needs. They do a very extensive financial analysis, and then they have, each team has a graduate landscape architect assigned to them, and they work with the graduate landscape architecture student on the final site plan. I need to emphasize that this is not a design studio. It is very much a real estate-oriented project. And a big part of it is obviously the market analysis and the financial analysis. That's just not a dream type of project. So the students were charged early on with creating a development vision and strategy. It was a very, very much a holistic approach. They were charged with not only coming up with a viable redevelopment proposal, but they also were charged with working with the community, the San Suu Kyi community, to resurrect this mill and improve the community. It had fallen on hard times. So they met with the San Suu Kyi Neighborhood Association many times, worked with the county, Greenville County, including Parks and Recreation, who administers or oversees the Swamp Rabbit Trail. And probably what was most fun to watch was just the interaction with the students, with former mill workers, families going back generations, and the students learning about the history of the mill and what the mill really meant to them and the sense of attachment that they had. So as I mentioned earlier, each team works on a final site plan, which includes the programming. And this is one team's proposal. All the students are told this must be a mixed-use development. And so with that, they needed to serve numerous other uses that the community needed. And this particular team came up with a single-family component, which was affordable housing and below market housing. They also worked very hard to come up with connectivity to the neighborhoods. There's a nearby elementary school, and of course the river and the swamp rabbit trail. And they also included in their plan a community center, which the neighborhood association really liked. And this team had an excellent proposal. Well, another team really focused on the historic structures that survived. And here are some photographs of those structures. They're very dilapidated, but at the same time, they had some great architectural detailing and a wonderful sense of character. So this particular team focused on these historic resources as a means of anchoring the redevelopment proposal and making, in effect, the boiler building, which you see in the upper right corner, kind of the focus of the development. We encourage the students to use a phasing approach. Again, this site was it's a very large site. It's over 220 acres, although the teams really focused on the 35 acres that was essentially the heart of the textile mill and the properties. This particular team had three phases, as you can see, with the first phase really focused on obtaining the entitlements, the environmental remediation that would continue, and all the site work and infrastructure. And you know, these projects, as part of the development proposal, they were all multi-year projects. So students take courses as part of this graduate program in everything from finance, market analysis, architecture, city and regional planning, law, and even construction science. And they're charged with using something from all of their courses that they've had over the previous 18 months. And they come up with a very realistic and thorough construction schedule, as you see here. And then, as you can imagine, a big part of it is the financial analysis. They have to complete redevelopment proposals that are financially viable. And that is within what we call the risk-reward framework. And a big part of that are the tax incentives. As you can see here, one team looked at both federal and state tax credits. In South Carolina, we have a wonderful state tax incentive called the Textile Revitalization Act, which is a state credit. Same with the Abandoned Buildings Revitalization Act, which was originally created as a vacant big box state tax credit to repurpose those buildings. This team took advantage of all those, and especially the federal historic tax credits as well. They also had to complete a thorough development budget, which in this case, this particular team came up with one of the larger budgets, $89 million. But they did a good job with a full development budget. And this is over the 3 to 5 year period of the development. And as I said earlier, you know, they have to demonstrate that it's financially viable. And that's all about the returns that the proposed project will generate. This is kind of the bottom line. And in this particular case, this team did a good job with their financial analysis where they had good unleveraged and leveraged internal rates of return. And the jury liked that very much. But again, as I said earlier, what was most gratifying was getting the response from the neighborhood association and what they liked and the input that they provided. And then the students had to also show where they were going to obtain their debt, where they were going to obtain their equity, and how that would work in terms of financing the project. So it's a very realistic approach. We try to make it as real world as possible And the students thoroughly enjoyed working on this project. Again, it was much more than just a simple real estate project. It had a lot of layers to it throughout the community and the history of it. The students found it challenging, but at the same time, it was very rewarding, and it was a real pleasure to have the opportunity to work with the EPA on this. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kwame Owusu-Deku, and I am an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of West Florida. So I'm going to be talking to you today about some engagement that I was involved with as part of the CUP program between September 2017 and May 2019. There were two sites involved over the course of this period. So the former Scambia Wood Treatment Plant in Pensacola, Florida, and also the American Creosote Works, also in Pensacola, Florida. These two sites had two different, local government jurisdictions. One was with Escambia County, and so we engaged with the staff of the county and the county commissioners on working on this site. And then we also worked with the city of Pensacola staff. And then between these two sites, we also engage with two private firms as well, and I'll talk a bit more about how these private firms came into play. So this engagement covered four semesters between spring 2018 and spring 2019. So just like the previous presenter, this work was a team-based effort. Students worked in teams, and we had teams with as few as two students and some as many as six students, just depending on course enrollment. And I would work with the community partners, whether it be county staff or city staff, or even the private firm, to determine the scope of work, you know, for each semester's planning. So students would enroll in this course, and they were presented with this real-life project, and I would divide the scope of work according to the number of teams that we have in each course. And then students would have the choice of selecting and ranking, you know, their order of teams. So they would have to tell me through a survey which is the first choice team, second choice, all the way down to the last team, and provide some justification as to why they wanted that team. And then the teams were assigned on a first-come, first-served basis. So this way, no student really got beyond their third choice, and that really helped with just their engagement and the quality of work that they, on the quality of effort, the level of effort that they put into the work. I also assigned professional advisors to these teams. Some of them were EPA Region 4 staff. Some were county staff, city staff. But assigning the advisors was not always successful just because of time constraints mainly. The students had, I guess, checkpoints throughout the semester. They'd have to submit an outline of their work plan. They would have to submit a half draft. They would have to submit a full draft, and then the final submission, and have a final presentation of some sort. And so it was hard to have these professional advisors, with all that they had going on, also give detailed feedback to the students. But if it was just, you know, pointing them in the direction of where to find resources, that was usually an easier advising role than, say, having to schedule regular interviews and check-ins or some other, you know, more involved engagement. So the first site is a Scambian, former Scambia wood treatment site. This is an aerial photo from, I believe, June 2012 of the site. The site currently doesn't look like this. It's overgrown with grass and, you know, a few more trees. And so in the fall of 2017, EPA Region staff, Francisco Scott Miller and Eric Spalvin, reached out to me by email, and they said, hey, we realize you have expertise in urban planning. Would you be interested in helping a redevelopment process for this site. The county wants to turn it into a commerce park. And I was all yes for the planning process, but I was very, very nervous about jumping into Superfund, because this was my first foray into Superfund. You know, in school I had heard, you know, the word brownfield, you know, Superfund thrown about here and there, but it's not an area that I had explored in depth. But I said yes to this challenge, and so we got together with county staff, and we came up with about these number of teams for the students to get involved with. One was looking at the history and current conditions of the site. Anytime any county staff wanted to engage with this process, they had to sort of start their homework all over again, find out the history, find out the current status. And so we basically did this work for them, or that team of students did that work for them. Another team mapped all the current stakeholders and assessed the level of engagement of each stakeholder. So from county commissioners to community members, and assessed, you know, whether additional, you know, stakeholder engagement needed to be done. One team was responsible for looking at the best practices in this kind of redevelopment, specifically for other commercial sites. And then another team also looked at potential investors, you know, which outside companies were willing to invest in developing this site at the Commerce Park, or willing to become one of the tenants on this site. They also surveyed local businesses around the area, what they thought about the site and what could be done. And then options and feasibility actually took two examples and decided to explore them in depth, you know, how possible, how feasible are some of these options that are being thrown out. And that's where one of the private companies we worked with came into play as we explored one of the options they had for a waste repurposing facility. Then the last team took into consideration what would buildings look like on this site, you know, where are the sewer lines, where are the power lines, and just using GIS did, you know, a bird's eye view, the layout, you know, possible layout for this. So we visited the site. That was one of the first things we did, and in each of the engagements, we tried to do that. It wasn't possible each and every semester with each and every course in each of the project, but where we could, it was important for the students to be able to visit the site, you know, walk around, see it, and then really wrap their minds around what was going on. Another important thing was to produce products beyond just the written report or write-up, you know, for the community partners. So this is an example of the timeline of the history and current conditions for this semester are made for the county, you know. And so these visuals help with visioning this and stimulating discussion, you know. So whether it's a reflective piece as a timeline or some of the more futuristic visualizations that we have, they were all useful for, you know, helping to stimulate discussion. So students were able to present their findings to the Board of County Commissioners at the end of the spring semester, and they got great feedback. The council was excited to work with them in subsequent semesters. So toward the end of that spring 2018 semester, I was again approached by the EPA Region 4 staff. This time it was Peter Thorpe and the City of Pensacola staff, and they said, we have this site which was the former American Creamsuit Works in downtown Pensacola, that, you know, we want to remediate, and the consensus is to turn it into a passive park. We've done some engagement with the community members who live around this park, people in favor of passive park, but it's been a while. I think the last engagement was maybe in 2010, and so the city staff wanted to come before city council with the proposals to acquire, you know, a few of the parcels were not owned by the city, and so they wanted the city council to approve acquisition of all of the parcels. And so they wanted to come with a visual, a new vision of what the site could look like. And so they were like, yeah, can you do a design for passive park for us? And I was like, we would love to help you out, but we're not designers. We're not architects, we're passive designers. The best you can do is GIS, and that, you know, these kinds of layouts you can already do on your own. But the city staff were very tenacious. So they came back to us later and said, hey, a local architectural firm has reached out to us, and they want to, you know, they're also interested in helping us, you know, design the passive park. Would you be interested in collaborating with them? And, you know, that was a wonderful opportunity, because it allowed these students who are mainly undergraduates and mainly environmental scientists to have, you know, this a design experience, you know, have a foray into the design world. So the architects visited. This was, I think, a six-week summer course. So over the course of 5 weeks, they visited classes about four times and gave us about 3 hours at a time through just the design process and thinking about design. So this is what some of our design sessions look like. We'll be calling over maps, figuring out where to put trails or how the landscaping should rise and fall, thinking about where to put restrooms, concessions. There was talk of putting a memorial on the place. One team was designing an amphitheater. Another team was even thinking about an actual building on a portion of the site to serve as some form of a training institute. And so, yeah, it was a very thriving process, and students really got a lot out of the experience. So the image on the left is just an example of some of the students' initial design concepts. And then the one on the right is the final architect's professional rendering, you know, so how they took the student design and, you know, turned it into that at the end of the day. And the final professional rendering was what we presented to the city council at the end of the summer course. And the council unanimously voted to acquire all parcels on the site so that remediation could continue in earnest on the site. Yeah, so towards the end of the summer, I circled back to the Standard Council. Okay, we seem to have a very successful spring 2018 run. What can we do in the fall? And our point of contact said, you know, when we reached out to county commissioners in that initial current stakeholder mapping phase, we didn't really get any feedback from them, you know, about, I think only one commissioner actually responded. And so they said, you know, if we can get students on these commissioners' calendars, set up meetings with them, interview them, we can really get a collective vision of these commissioners. Because due to sunshine laws in the state of Florida, you know, these public officials cannot have private meetings about public issues. And so at any time that this issue of, you know, this site, you know, this remediated site came up in meetings, they could never give enough attention, they ran out of time, even in their own planning meetings, they could never get to it. So we're like, okay, if we assign students to these commissioners and they interview them, that would be very helpful. So that's exactly what we did. We had 5 students for each of the 5 commissioners. They got on their calendars, they learned. Some of them had never conducted an interview in their life, and so they got the collective vision, and the idea was that the general consensus was that all commissions wanted to see the site redeveloped, even though some of them had different opinions as to exactly what kind of redevelopment, you know, whether they wanted more private firms, or versus more public firms and the like. So we were done with that fall 2018 engagement, and we came into the semester of spring 2019. And we then were ready to continue on with the county again. But come the start of the spring 2019 semester, our point of contact very unexpectedly resigned. And so we were left hanging high and dry. And students had already been introduced to this project, and we were ready to move ahead. And then no one at the county was in such a state of flux that there was no way they were going to be able to continue our engagement. So that's when we had to pivot. We quickly reached out to one of the private firms who had been interested in developing a waste repurposing facility on the site. And we're like, how can we help you? And they were like, you can help us a lot. And so we came up with these teams as well, one that reviewed the technology they were going to use and basically translated into layman's terms so they could use it as an educational tool. We explored project financing and for, you know, their investments. We looked at all the legal issues they needed to make sure they were kosher on. We explored potential environmental and land use impacts of their proposed redevelopment. We engaged the community on what they thought about this new waste repurposing facility, whether they would patronize it, and then finally we looked at other funding sources that they could also explore. So a number of takeaways or lessons. It's to definitely recognize the varying needs of partners. So the needs of a private firm are obviously different from those of a public agency, whether it's a county or a city. And realizing even the scale of engagement, even the level of, I guess, manpower, you know, so the county definitely has more staff to work with, more people to consult, the cities are on a smaller scale. And so being very cognizant of, you know, these different needs and even just resource abilities. It's important to start planning for the engagement early. I think in each engagement, the planning has to start at least, at the very least, a semester ahead of time. And as a professor, sometimes it can be difficult when you haven't wrapped up one semester to begin planning for the next. But I think it's something we do in most of our jobs. And so, especially with projects like this, we have to be on top of that kind of planning. Next, to manage our expectations, our own expectations, expectations of our students, of what they can accomplish within the time frame of a semester, of the community partners, you know, aligning them with our semester timelines and aligning the students with their slower timelines compared to the limited, you know, 14 weeks that we have. Visioning to stimulate discussion was very useful, whether it was visiting a site, whether it was coming up with a map, whether it was coming up with a drawing. So these were very important in moving the conversation along. Connecting engagement activities to course content seems intuitive, but it was very important to help students, keep students grounded. A lot of times they get lost in the weeds of the project and forget, you know, how it actually ties back the overall goals of the course they were engaged in. Giving students opportunities to exercise autonomy was important, so the fact that they selected their own team definitely helped with the quality of work that they did. But also giving them opportunities to demonstrate what they have learned. You know, these final presentations to the county commissioners or to city council, or even just to each other in the classroom were very important for them to basically have some closure and demonstrate how much they had grown and learned over the course of the semester. It's important to be flexible in the things where we have to pivot quickly to working with the, directly with the private firm. If we had not been flexible enough, the students would have missed out on a very helpful opportunity. And prepare for long-term engagement. None of these sites have broken down. The American Future Works is still being remediated. I think it's almost complete. Escambia Wood is ready for reuse, but again, none of these sites have broken down. And we're still committed, as long as our community partners are willing to work with us, to continue, you know, engaging in projects. And lastly, just say yes to new experiences. When I first approached about doing Superfund redevelopment work, I barely knew what a Superfund site was, but I said yes. And I think that the work that the students produced, the good work, the great work that they did, you know, actually, you know, led to more opportunities with the CUP program, you know, doing some interagency work with HEMA that obviously wasn't covered in this presentation. So, yeah, never be afraid to, you know, take a risk. And yeah, I just want to say thank you to department, college, university, some of the EPA region 4 staff, the county, the city, and all the students who engaged in all the courses that made this work possible. Thank you very much.
Okay, hello. Hi. My name is Andrew Gonneau, and I am an assistant professor of sociology at Maryville College here in East Tennessee. And I want to start by thanking the EPA for hosting. One second, I need to get rid of some reverb. Okay. Thank you to the EPA and Scott Miller in particular for bringing me onto this project and to working with me over the last couple of years. It's been a great experience both for myself and for my student that I'll be talking about here momentarily.
So Andrew, this is Jean Ballin. I'm going to walk you through a quick change on something because we're getting an audio echo, and it's likely with your phone setup. So one of the things that I'd like you to do, Andrew, if you're in the Adobe environment, at the very top of the screen, look for a green speaker icon, and I want you to click on that, and I want you to mute the Adobe audio. And I apologize for that brief disruption to the audience, but I think that the echo would have been too disruptive to carry on. So I just want to get him to mute that Adobe audio. And then, Andrew, in just a moment, I'm going to unmute you, and let's see if it's any better. All right, so, Andrew, I've unmuted your line. Can you say hello?
Can you hear me now?
Hello?
Okay. Sorry about that little technological difficulty. I introduced myself and just said thank you at the outset, but I'm going to go ahead for time purposes and keep moving forward. Talk about the project that I worked on back in 2017. And the project was at a site, a Superfund site, called the Smoky Mountain Smelter Superfund. And it is located in South Knoxville, Tennessee, which is close to downtown. I have this next slide shows that map a little bit closer. If you can see in here in Knoxville, let me get my arrow going. This is the site. It is a 13-acre site about 5-6 miles from downtown Knoxville. And a little closer up look at it in the next slide, you can see kind of what remains of a former smelting operation that was in operation back in, throughout the 80s and early 90s. And the site is located in a mixed industrial area that has some commercial but has also residential areas, which is generally a working class area of town. And one of the more important site characteristics is that it has two rail lines that run along the east and west sides of the property. I will talk about those a little bit more here in a moment. Another thing to note about this property is that it's also bordered by a public housing complex called Montgomery Village, which you can see in the upper right-hand side of this map, just across from the railroad track. And Montgomery Village is the highest density of people that were impacted by this redevelopment, and it's also an area of high crime that presented some particular challenges for this work. As a public housing complex, there were some issues both in terms of gathering input from the community, also some issues with potential redevelopment as well. Okay, so a little bit of background on the Smoky Mountain Smelters Superfund site. From 1922 to 1948, it was operated by the Knoxville Fertilizer Company as a fertilizer production plant. Part of their operations were responsible for some of the hazardous materials that were left behind. And after 1948, the property changed ownership multiple times, but as far as I know, it continued to be used primarily as a fertilizer production plant. But it came under ownership of the Smoky Mountain Smelters in 1979, and Smoky Mountain Smelters acquired the property and operated a secondary aluminum smelter for the next 15 years or so. Smoky Mountain Smelter shut down in 1994 and basically abandoned the site, leaving behind piles of aluminum dross and salt cake, all of which was left uncovered and lacked drainage control. And so, as I said, both the fertilizer production and smelter waste were what led to the contamination of the site's soils, surface water, and groundwater. The EPA placed Smoky Mountain Smelters on the national priority list in 2010. And as far as I know, the EPA is still working with a group of potentially responsible parties to reach agreements for the design and construction of the final remedy outlined in the 2010 Record of Decision. So that's a little background on the site. In terms of my work on the site. I was contacted in early 2017 to help work with the EPA to incorporate community involvement in the redevelopment of the site. I've lived in South Knoxville for many years, and I was familiar with the site. So I jumped at this opportunity, and it was during the first year or two of my my work at Maribel College. So I saw this as a great opportunity. It was also a great opportunity for me to bring on a undergraduate to do so as a research assistant. At Maribel College, students are required to do a senior thesis, basically a two-semester project during their final year. And I had an environmental studies student that I was advising that year, and I told her about this project, and she agreed to jump on board, and she did a wonderful job, and it was a great learning process, both for me as an advisor and thesis mentor, and her as well as an undergraduate student getting to do some real research out in the field, working with people on something that really matters. So in the fall of 2017, the student whose name was Anna, along with myself and Scott Miller and some other local community members, conducted two community forums at a local community center aimed at gathering community input about potential issues for the site once remediation was completed. One of the challenges for hosting these community forums was, as I said, that the area is, especially the area around Montgomery Village, is not the safest site. And so there were issues, especially with me bringing an undergraduate out into the field. And so we decided to host it at this local community center, which was maybe a mile or two up the road. And I'll come back to that here in a minute. But we advertised with flyers as well as on some community Facebook sites and some local listservs to try and, you know, cast our net wide and to bring in as many different interested parties and stakeholders in the South Knoxville and broader Knoxville area. These forums began with an overview of the site, a little bit of its history and its current status, but the bulk of it was an open discussion where we would field questions from community members, hoping to solicit insights onto what they wanted to see happen at the site. I will talk about some of the feedback we got from that here in a minute, but we also sent out an electronic survey, an online survey, to try and get at some of the people that were unable to attend in person. And so we put together a survey and posted it to various community websites as well. In terms of the feedback we got from the community, I could say in general it ranged pretty widely. These meetings, people would often bring up all sorts of different points about community needs, what it would mean to redevelop a site, in particular a Superfund site. But some of the feedback we got, you know, some called for some agricultural space in this community, which is classified as a food desert. They thought that some type of community green space or farmers market would be a way to not only provide food in this food desert, but also to provide some economic opportunities as well. Others called for mixed-use spaces that would have some type of multi-purpose space with perhaps community advancement programs, a marketplace, some mentioned like a library, things along those lines. Others favored a more commercial use of the property, basically something that would provide jobs, whether in retail, industrial, or whatever the case may be. And others even thought that the site should be converted into a law enforcement substation that would help address the crime and endemic drug use in the area. But in general, so, you know, we heard from all sorts of different people about what they thought would be a good use of this property, but I would say the common theme was that recognizing that this was an area of low socioeconomic class and that the solution should do something, or the redevelopment should do something to help or benefit this community. In terms of the outcomes, let me move to the next slide. We finished collecting data in the fall of 2017. I have continued to be in conversations with the EPA and other stakeholders about potential redevelopment plans. Many of these have been hampered by existing issues, both with primarily around determining who owns the land and how to bring this land back onto the public tax roll. As I said, this land was basically abandoned back in the 1990s, so that presented an issue in terms of that first step to start envisioning what could become of this property. But in the meantime, there was a private consulting firm out of Portland, Oregon, I believe, that has done a reuse assessment that has kind of incorporated some of the ideas that stemmed from our research, as well as some other ideas from talking with community partners and stakeholders. And one development that's been particularly promising and actually kind of innovative was spurred by a local community member who attended one of these meetings and who has subsequently started to lead an effort towards bringing a small rail transportation station to the greater Knoxville area, right? So as I mentioned, this Superfund site is bordered by two rail lines. Knoxville has traffic problems like most other large cities, and his idea was that we should develop a small rail line station. And this photograph in this slide is actually a picture of some of the train cars from, I believe they were formerly used in San Diego. He has, with a private investor, already purchased these train cars and is hoping to bring them to Knoxville. But putting together this project obviously would take some time, and this is ongoing, to say the least. But there are still conversations taking place around this. And finally, in terms of lessons learned, for me, many of the lessons learned really come back to the fact that this is a marginalized community. As a sociologist, this raises all sorts of interesting concerns and constraints and possibilities for redevelopment. But in this context, it certainly presented problems for gathering community input, as well as some of the possibilities for redevelopment. Beginning with community input, I would say that it was limited, right? As I said, we did not hold our forums on Montgomery Village property, which probably, as I said, is the highest density population that is going to be affected by this redevelopment. And, we faced criticism at our public forums for not holding it on the property. I explained my reasons for that, but very much agreed with many of the audience that we needed to make sure that we got everybody in that area's input and to do everything we could to engage them in this process. One of our reactions to this was also to create that web survey, but again, technology limitations often limit the usefulness of an online survey in an area of low socioeconomic class. The other one has to do with redevelopment possibilities. Many community members expressed concerns about turning this site some of the ideas put forth about redevelopment and the use of it for whether it was, green space or recreational fields. As you might expect, there is a lot of distrust in East Tennessee, I guess in the South in general, concerning both the EPA and the federal government and issues of Superfund sites in general. A lot of them were really concerned about the idea of even creating a place for use on top of a Superfund site. Furthermore, many of them were skeptical about the idea of creating green spaces in this area because they thought it would just lead to a space for people to gather and, use drugs or whatever the case may be. They weren't very confident about the idea of green space being beneficial to the area. And so, those were some of the limitations. The other limitation, which was also an opportunity, was the railroad tracks themselves, right? And as an industrial area along this road in South Knoxville, it was the possibilities for redevelopment were somewhat limited. At the same time, I guess this was also that possibility that perhaps a small rail line could run through the area, and that if this site could be used as a rail station, certainly it could connect people to economic opportunities in the city, as well as transportation around. So that's basically all I have for today. I want to echo that this was a great opportunity for engaging students in this type of research. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to participate.
So, Scott, if you're trying to unmute your line, I'm going to try to help you here. So, Scott, if you're with us, please feel free to say hi.
Hello.
Okay, you are back.
Perfect. Hello, sorry about that. First off, thank you to Andrew, Kwame, and Robert for sharing. We're going to get into some questions here in just a minute, but I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised at some of the outcomes here, and we'll talk to that in just a second. So a big thank you to all of our presenters for their fantastic presentation and their efforts to work with us on this redevelopment planning efforts. The CUP program, it was great to hear perspectives from the colleges and universities that have partnered with us. These types of collaborations are very important. Showcasing perspectives, approaches, and successful projects is a key part of Superfund redevelopment work. Along with providing examples, we have found that sharing guidance, tools, lessons learned, and resources is an impactful way to promote safe and beneficial reuse. So another big thank you to all of our presenters for the participation in today's webinars. I would like to wrap up our time today by providing you with some resources, and we will use the remaining time for any additional questions. Here are some of the tools available for encouraging redevelopment at Superfund sites. You can find links to all these resources in the resources panel on your screen. Also available in the resources panel is a link to the final Superfund Task Force final report outlining the accomplishments of the Superfund Task Force. Here's a list of my fellow Superfund redevelopment coordinators by region. If you have any region-specific or site-specific questions, these are the folks you should reach out to as needed. If you have any general questions or would like more information about Superfund redevelopment, please don't hesitate to contact the project manager for EPA Superfund redevelopment, Frank Avasato, or Bill Denman, redevelopment and branch. Chemicals Branch Chief. Now I'd like for us to pause for a minute to answer a few questions. While we are going over the questions, we are going to switch the screen view to the survey screen. Please take a minute to respond to the following questions.
And Scott, I'll just confirm that we did pull up that survey layout for everyone. And for those of you in the audience, if you have additional questions or comments, if you have not yet entered them in, that enter questions window is still available in the lower right. So I just wanted to put that in. For those of you that may have no questions or comments, you can also enter in no questions or comments. That's just equally as useful, so we know that we're allocating enough time for Q&A with our organizers.
If it's okay, Jean, I'm going to go ahead with some questions that we've received.
That sounds great.
And this question is for any of the presenters, and I definitely want to answer it as well. Do any of these planning projects end up informing actual redevelopment efforts?
And that's for anyone that's presented today.
Scott, I'll be happy to answer that one. As you can personally attest, I think the one that you helped us on, the former Union Bleachery Cone Mill site in Greenville, it's on the verge of becoming a real project, as have a number of the practicum projects we've worked on. In fact, the board that oversees our program always kids me about, why don't you get some sort of finder fee for doing that for private developers?
Robert, it's a good time to ask, because the private developers were the ones that just wrote an offer on the property, and lo and behold, this redevelopment plan that you and your students had come up with was part of the marketing package that the private firm that listed the site for sale included as part of the presentation. And lo and behold, the developers are coming to us with a plan that looks eerily similar to the one that you and your students designed. I'll just say that must be great minds think alike, but one of the other questions that we have in queue relates to, are any private interest involved in this? And I can tell you they most definitely are, and we'll get into that further in just a minute. Does anyone else want to speak to that question?
Kwame here. I would just say the projects or the work that students do most definitely does inform actual redevelopment. I think in the case of the Pensacola area, the sites aren't at the stage where anything has been constructed, but one of the sites is definitely ready for your use, and the conversations are ongoing. It's just that, you know, it takes a while to get from, okay, yes, we agree to do this, and we've actually built something.
Thank you, Kwame. And Andrew, did you want to say anything? Because I think the short answer is, for the Smoky Mountain Smelter site, the answer is yes. And Andrew mentioned an individual that came through the meetings process that he and his students set up. And that person didn't just come through. That person has the rail cars that were just pictured. They are in storage right now, and they brought forward a private firm from Canada, a real estate development firm. And we're in the process of working through an area-wide reuse redevelopment plan exercise with them, and they've started to pick up parcels. And our three parcels of that Superfund site are just one piece of the area-wide piece. And that site is served by two active rail lines, and that was one of the things that attracted them to have interest in that site itself. So let's go for another question then. So number two was, okay, so how will private sector interests involved with these projects? Anybody want to speak to that?
Scott, this is Robert. I'll go ahead and respond to that one. You know, we actually solicited the private sector to critique and provide input to the students. And, you know, in our particular case, this project, a lot of developers knew about it, but they had no idea that Clemson was involved in it. And with that, you know, they got excited, and they were eager to share their thoughts. And really haven't had too much of a problem in the past with similar projects. Occasionally we'll get somebody who's a stakeholder that says, no, everything is proprietary that I'm sharing. I don't want this to go beyond what I tell the students. But we actively seek private sector folks to get involved and provide their input.
Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, this is Andrew. I would say that, you know, in the Smoky Mountain Smelter site, you know, we did not hear much from private sector businesses, but we did have a number of nonprofits included in our conversations, including the Transit Alliance of East Tennessee, which is the organization trying to build the light rail system, and other design centers and organizations like that. So the nonprofit sector was really influential in the process at Smoky Mountain Smelters.
Kwame here. I think in my experience, the challenge is actually reining in some of the private sector interests, because you know, the public agencies make these sites or get them to the state where they're ready for reuse, and it's typically, I think in most cases, the private sector that comes into their redevelopment. So uniting with the private sector, it was important to remind them that they have to always make the case for the greater good, the public good, you know, that, you know, the jobs wouldn't be for only a specific segment of the population, that there would be trickle-down effects, you know. And so I think it was almost like a reverse challenge of making sure that private sector interest didn't overtake some of these redevelopment initiatives.
So I'm going to take a shot at a few that are really quick, and then I'm going to come back to one that maybe take us just a second. So can brownfields projects be enrolled in the CUP program? Yes, they can. Let us know. We'll help you. We'll facilitate that on your behalf. How are CUP projects funded? That one's easy. There is no funding for CUP projects. It's an all-volunteer army. Which EPA employees typically work on redevelopment plans for Superfund sites? Typically that's remedial project managers, but community involvement coordinators are involved as well. Come back.
Hey, and Scott, this is Bill.
Yes, sir.
I just add in that also the Superfund attorneys are a critical part to get involved early to identify any, you know, legal issues that a developer or redevelopment plan might need to know.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, Scott, can I go back to your response on how the CUP projects are funded? You're right, because of the fact that EPA does not provide any funding, we actually went to the county and said, you know, we're in partnership with the EPA on this project, and we were able to get some, you know, it's not a very large sum of money, but it funded the printing cost and things like that for us that came from the local county council representative for that area.
Well, that's fantastic, Robert. Thank you for sharing that. So coordinating remediation redevelopment effort can be difficult. The timing of these two efforts may not make redevelopment easy. Do you have any general recommendations for coordinating remediation with redevelopment efforts? And that's a question for everyone.
Scott, this is Robert. Sorry to jump in again, but I think a good lesson is, you know, a lot of contracts allow for release provisions whereby the EPA will say, well, this area was not impacted, and there's, you know, even a no further action letter. So you take a phased approach and you work in those areas that do not require additional environmental remediation, and that's exactly what's happening, I think, with the Union Bleachery Cone Mill site. You know, there are some areas that I suspect the private developer will go ahead and start redeveloping and just staying out of the EPA's way on the more contaminated areas of the site.
Thank you, Robert. That's a good point.
Kwame here, and I agree with Robert's point. The same with the Escambia retreating site, that there's still some portions, a few parcels, you know, very few that I think are still being monitored, and so if any redevelopment should begin, any reconstruction should begin, it wouldn't be on those sites. But I think it's important not to wait until all you know, the ducks in a row, because, for example, if you start planning for redevelopment when remediation is going on, that can actually inform the remediation, and that happened with the American Creator Works site, where there was a big push for having a building on the site. And so in thinking about remediation, we explored, you know, could we, you know, layer soil in certain, you know, certain levels in certain portions of the site that could actually withstand a building so that it wouldn't affect the cap, you know. And so I think that was a great moment where we knew we're ways away from actual, you know, redevelopment, but then at the remediation stage, because we're thinking about redevelopment, it informed the actual remediation process.
Thank you, Kwame. Good one. So here's one for you, Bill. What are the tools, if any, available to help prospective purchasers and developers limit liability when acquiring contaminated property?
Oh boy, there's several webinars and there's a lot of information out there on that. I would suggest if you're new to this, would be to look up our top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site fact sheet. That kind of directs you towards how to address that liability, how to achieve bona fide prospective purchaser status, which is a key component. But as far as specific tools and ways that EPA can help, we can. One of the results of the task force was to start issuing prospective purchaser agreements again, which is a three-way agreement between a prospective purchaser, EPA, and the Department of Justice, which gives some liability protection. Especially in Region 4, we have a great process that we use called the Prospective Purchaser Inquiry Process, where if someone is interested in purchasing and redeveloping a site, we'll kind of talk them through where we're at with the site, talk them through any issues we propose redevelopment, talk them through, you know, any liens that may be on the property and how those could be satisfied, and afterwards issue a comfort letter, or what's sometimes called a status letter, which is something that has been very useful in getting financing for cleanup, I mean, for purchase and things like that. So there are a lot of tools. All of these are discussed on our Superfund redevelopment website. So again, you could look at the top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site fact sheet. You could go to the Superfund redevelopment website, and those are discussed in further detail. Or probably the best thing to know is, as Scott said earlier, is depending on what region you're in, is to see what the who the Superfund redevelopment coordinator is, and get in touch with them and let them know what you're thinking, and see what they may be able to connect you up with. Because every region does it a little bit differently. Regions 3 and 7 have a very similar process to ours as far as, you know, dealing with prospective purchasers. You know, we can. We have lots of tools and lots of certainly willing to work with you to help promote redevelopment.
Thank you, Bill. So another question: what are some of the unexpected outcomes gained from the partnerships? And that's for everyone.
This is Bill, and I guess while everyone else may be thinking about how they would respond to that, Scott, I think one of the unexpected outcomes that I notice, and I think is very, you know, something we've talked about a little here, is the benefit to the community engagement portion of Superfund, and it's getting the community involved in the planning, in the future use, so that, you know, you gain that support early on, because they may, you know, have a significant part in making those decisions. And also, you know, some of the things that the CUP program can do for communities that EPA just simply can't do, you know, either because it's outside of the scope of responding to the particular site or things like that. And so, you know, like some of the things I mentioned when I gave kind of an overview of the CUP program, I think those are some things that, you know, we didn't really intend, but, you know, the professors and the students, after talking with the community, saw there was a need and fulfilled that need.
Thank you, Bill. I think that's a good point. I mean, that the community perspective and an appreciation for the history of the area and the site and what, you know, what the desire is of the local community, I think, to me, was just is an amazing thing that you get, along with a lot of our folks that work in this field, such as Dr. Benedict, on local planning commissions or know a lot of local stakeholders, and by extension, they get involved. And it helps to make a, I think, make a better product, as I would describe it.
Yeah, this is Andrew. I'd just echo the community engagement is invaluable in this process. Many of these Superfund sites are located in areas with disadvantaged populations around them, and issues of environmental and social justice kind of rise to the forefront here. And so beginning with taking their perspective into account and hearing them and addressing their needs is an important step in this process. And I thought it was, it was encouraging to know that this, you know, as I learned about this aspect of redevelopment and Superfund sites, that they actually, that, you know, steps are taken in this direction. I think that was certainly, you know, something I learned and took away from this experience.
Yeah, Kwame here. So I'm going to answer this a bit selfishly because I feel like the benefits to community and benefits to students are almost explicitly written into the CUP agreement or how CUP is designed. But actually, the unexpected benefits to myself, you know, as a professor professionally, you know, working on this initially seemed like a lot more work. I seemed to be dedicating many, many more hours than some of my colleagues to this work. But then this work, which was volunteer and paid and free, actually led to other funded opportunities, lay the groundwork, you know, to be competitive for other funding opportunities. So I mean, I'd encourage all the professors on the call to, you know, really invest in this, you know, that, you know, basically, you know, good work comes back to you when you, you know, you offer your services to in the benefit of the community.
Thank you, Kwame. This has been really good. We're gonna I think we need to wrap up here. We're going over our time a little bit, but I guess that was expected. Thank you once again, everybody, for your participation. One last question: how do I learn about CUP opportunities for students at my university? Send me an email or call me, miller.scott@epa.gov, or 404-562-9120, and we will get you set up. And thanks again for everyone's participation. And Gene, I know I just got an email that says you're about to jump on here and take charge. So we will step back. So thanks, everybody, for your participation.
Well, thank you so much. So we are just coming right up on our scheduled end time. So I want to echo that thanks to everyone who signed in, both our presenters, our organizers, as well as our participants who attended today's session. But before we close out, in addition to saying thank you, I want to provide you with a few quick final reminders. So if you enjoyed today's session, I strongly encourage that you visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org and sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. We highlight sessions like today's. I'll also remind you that if you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, those are already posted on the seminar homepage. I highlighted that at the start of today's class. You would have gotten a link to it as part of your confirmation and reminder emails. You'll find those same links also available on the right side under the middle box that says related resources or websites. So you can scroll through and find a link to the seminar homepage and then click it and press browse to open it on up. Contact information for presenters and organizers is also posted there, and I would ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of our delivery today. That feedback form will give you opportunities to share thoughts both on the content that we covered, but also the tools and approach we used to host our session. So we do continuously look at your feedback to continue these online deliveries, so please take a moment and share your thoughts. For those of you looking for CEUs or PDHs, while we do not offer those credit hours for these courses, I can provide you with a participation certificate immediately upon submitting feedback for the seminar. As long as you check the box that you attended the entire session or replayed the whole thing, once you submit feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate that you can download or print out for your own records. If you did have other people joining at your location, just send them the link to the feedback form. They can fill it out on their own, even if they didn't register individually, and get their own certificate for their own records. So again, I do read each and every one of those submissions, and I want to thank those of you who share your thoughts. So with that, today's session was recorded. You'll receive an email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks with instructions on how to play it back on demand. And we'll also include resources on finding others archived in this series. So with that, that's the end of my official reminders. Again, just one big great thank you to everyone who was here for our broadcast. And we'll go ahead and form